All right. Well, that is Bing Gong, co-host with me, Karin Nyhus. This is Post Carbon Radio. And here it is, almost the end of March. Not only is it officially spring now, but next month is our now annual climate change mobilization. Bing, you're going to go to D.C., right?
Correct. Eleanor and I will be there for the march, April 29th.
All right. And hope you bring back some good audio. But before we dive into the show today, I know you wanted to share some announcements about an upcoming event, right?
Yes. We have a fundraiser for West Marin Standing Together. It will be an insider's perspective, Lynn Woolsey in conversation with Mark Dowie. Mark Dowie is an investigative historian who lives on the edge of Tamales Bay, and it'll be Sunday, April 23rd at 6 p.m. at the Dance Palace in Point Reyes Station. So there's limited seating, only 175 tickets available, so order your tickets now. You could go to Eventbrite and put in Lynn Woolsey.
Okay. And at the end of the show, we will repeat that. So if you missed those details, stay tuned. We also will have a calendar of a lot of upcoming events. So get your pencil sharpened or whatever devices you're going to use. We're going to have announcements from events all around the Bay as well as in West Marin. All right. So as we leave Water Week and enter the lead-up to the People's Climate March on April 29th, which is happening all over the country, we wanted to look again at climate change from a big-picture point of view. With the myriad disruptions of the Trump administration, we could take many wide-lens angles on that. We've got Scott Pruitt heading up the EPA. We've got the hatchet job underway at that agency, the undermining of what Steve Bannon calls the administrative state in general. Including judicial deference to the expertise of federal agencies. That's potentially under attack if Gorsuch is nominated, et cetera. But anyway, today we chose war. Today we're talking about climate change in the context of militarism for many reasons. But one reason, as our guest will tell you, is that war and militarism aren't getting enough attention from our movements these days in general, let alone with respect to their effects on climate change. So to discuss this in more depth, we're very pleased to be joined, first of all, on the phone by Janet Wheel. Janet is a longtime peace activist. She served on the Code Pink National Staff for several years until October 2016. She co-founded the San Francisco 99% Coalition during the Occupy movement, and she's taken part in anti-nuclear and anti-militarism protests in the Nevada desert since 1995. She recently moved away from the Bay Area to Palm Springs, but we're very happy that she's joining us on the phone. Welcome, Janet.
Thanks so much, Karin.
Tell us, is it
beautiful to hear the names of those places that I know so well in West Marin County, and I'm delighted to connect with your audience.
Good. Well, tell us, is the desert in bloom down there with all this rain? Are you getting that rain?
The desert is in a super bloom right now. It's extraordinarily beautiful, and I've been very much enjoying hiking, photographing, and exploring Coachella Valley, which is really a paradise of desert flora and hummingbirds and other birds right now.
Wonderful.
And on the phone, we have with us Cecile Panetta. Cecile Panetta is an activist and writer of 9 published works of fiction and nonfiction. Her writing has received numerous awards and citations. Her most recent book is Three Tides, Writing at the Edge of Being. She is also author of Apology to a Whale, Words to Mend a World. Joanna Macy writes of her work, Cecile Panetta has the nerve to ask the one simple questions that could save us. What has happened to our mind that we are killing our world? And we'll be talking about that this hour. Welcome to Post Carbon Radio, Cecile.
Well, thank you. I am very honored to be here in such good company.
All right. And just to be clear, are we saying your name right? Is it Pineda?
Pineda.
Pineda. Okay. So I just want to say with our two guests from the outset of this show, this is kind of going to be a two-pronged conversation, as I anticipate. On the one hand, we want to talk about the meat and potatoes of climate change policy with respect to the military and the budget. And I think for the sake of our well-informed listeners, I'll just list the main points I think we're going to cover. We're going to talk about the financial cost of the military versus using money for climate change. We're going to talk about the destruction wrought by war and even non-war military activities, obviously including greenhouse gas emissions. We'll talk about the Trump era and Trump's proposal to give the military budget a boost. And then at the end, we're going to talk about what forms of resistance would appropriately respond to that. So we'll talk about all that for sure, and we're very glad to bring them back into focus. But we also have an opportunity with Cecile's presence to benefit from some more philosophical, linguistic, and even anthropological perspectives on the roots of this militarism and destruction in our own society. And Cecile, we'll be looking to you to define what that is all about. So just a heads up, listeners, that we may jump back and forth between pragmatic perspectives on the one hand and more abstract and even artistic ones on the other. So, Janet, let's start with you. You've recently moved to the desert, as we were just talking about. Can you just tell us a little about yourself and your early anti-war work from your bio? That was also in the desert, wasn't it?
I had a transformative life experience in August of 1995. I was inspired to go to the Nevada nuclear test site by Ken Buttigan, who's a well-known author and professor, and himself has done a lot of work over the years, the decades actually, for peace and against militarism and war. So that was my first deep encounter with being on the desert, experiencing the landscape in southern Nevada with a wonderful group of longtime peace activists, including leaders from the Shoshone Nation, and then going to the nuclear test sites and actually going on a Department of Defense tour that went all the way into Mercury, which is this pseudo town at the very heart of that extremely irradiated and devastated landscape, and hearing the propaganda about the nuclear weapons complex, which supposedly keeps us safe, but of course does nothing but destroy and make everybody on planet Earth more vulnerable in many ways. So that was really the beginning.
Mm-hmm. And so there was sort of an environmental aspect to it from the beginning, and now we have climate change. You worked for years with Code Pink and helped form the local coalition in San Francisco called the 99% Coalition during the Occupy movement, which, for full disclosure, is how I met you. And we invited you on the show today because, as an activist, one of the things you've been doing is pushing to bring social justice, climate change, and anti-war activity together. You sent me a recent article about this from The Nation called How to Revive the Peace Movement in the Trump Era. In it, author Daniel May argues that, quote, we need to merge social justice and anti-war activism. I have to say, it kind of made me sad to read this because, from my perspective, we've been talking about this for decades. What do you think? Does this sound like anything new to you?
What would be new is getting a practical plan together and, I think, really starting from new perspectives. And I am particularly inspired and thinking along these lines because of the indigenous-led struggles against the Dakota Access Pipeline and many other tar sands and other oil pipelines and other fossil fuel infrastructure projects. The anti-war and anti-militarism organizations, and to the extent they've been movements, have always been led by white people, and I'm a white person myself, although I do have also some Native background, but they've mostly been male-dominated, frankly, until fairly recently, and while extremely well-intentioned and good-hearted, the anti-war, anti-nuclear, anti-militarism organizations have operated from what now seems to me a fairly narrow framework and understanding of the issues. And I think that to be practical, we who are deeply concerned with and have worked on these issues need to first consider how are we going to organize and who and what projects are going to take leadership and get funded. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I'd be very interested to hear Cecile's take on this as well.
Do you want me to chime in at this point? I'd be quite happy to.
Sure.
I think it is really important to ground our discussion in some practicalities here. And in terms of reversing war and funding peace, the latest news is that New Haven, Connecticut, Charlottesville, Virginia, and Montgomery County, Maryland, have all passed resolutions opposing the Trump budget's moving of money from everything else into the military to the tune of $54 billion, as I'm sure your listeners know that figure, and urging that money be moved in the opposite direction. These resolutions are urging that national priorities be reversed. And for the benefit of your listeners who may want to get involved in the very practicalities of this movement, there are steps that can be taken, and it's very simple. I've had a communication with Mary at worldbeyondwar.org. If your listeners simply drop an email to Mary at worldbeyondwar.org, asking for her help in the initiative to reverse war funding and to fund peace. She will be glad to offer local groups templates, sample letters, ways that they can approach their local government to initiate such a resolution. So I think that is a very encouraging thing to know, that already this movement is afoot and that it is having, I believe, the potential of a groundswell.
Great. Thank you. I also want to say that the petition that passed in Charlottesville is available on David Swanson's site, davidswanson.org.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in this article, How to Revive the Peace Movement in the Trump Era by Daniel May, why do you think climate change isn't headlined in that framing? Either of you?
Okay, well, this is Janet, and since I sent that article along, I'll take a crack at answering. I mean, the short answer is I don't know because I'm not the author. The longer answer is that, unfortunately, for a long time, there's been a real gap, even on the part of very intelligent and otherwise well-connected communicators, both in the what we call the environmental issues movements, and then also what we call, and I do think that these terms are very inadequate in a way, but what we call the anti-war and anti-militarism movements. There's just a gap, which, of course, this radio station is a step toward bridging that gap. There's a fundamental and very problematic lack of making those connections. I would argue that right now it's more serious on the part of environmental organizations, particularly large and well-funded ones, that they never talk about the impacts of war and militarism, especially U.S. wars and militarism, but it is also very problematic on the side of peace/anti-war thinkers and writers, if they don't talk about climate change.
If you're just joining us, this is KWMR-FM. This is Post Carbon Radio. I'm your co-host, Karin Nyhus, with Bing Gong. And the voice you just heard was Janet Wheel, who is talking with us, along with Cecile Pineda, about the environmental and budget costs of militarism and their impact on the climate. So regarding the military's role in climate pollution, Jenna, I don't want to put you on the spot, but do you have one or two statistics on the role of the U.S. military in causing global warming?
Yes, thank you. I want to start by reading quickly from a book, The Green Zone, The Environmental Costs of Militarism by Professor Barry Sanders. So he did some very serious and important research on this, and here's what it boils down to. Even if every person, every automobile, and every factory suddenly emitted zero CO2 emissions, the military produces enough greenhouse gases by itself to place the entire globe in the most imminent danger of extinction from climate change. So I will back that up with a couple of other points. The U.S. and all militaries use an enormous amount of fossil fuels for, of course, all their transportation, jets, planes, battleships, boats, tanks, etc. And the U.S. military runs 800 military bases around the world. And not only is that billions of gallons of fossil fuel every year, hundreds of billions, actually, but much of that is much more polluting because it's for boats, jets, and other military vehicles than the gasoline that we use in our cars. Mm-hmm. So that's only looking at the fossil fuel use of the military. I do want to say some other things, you know, when appropriate, about other impacts of the military on climate change. But just think for a minute about the vehicles that the military uses. I'm asking your audience to draw to mind, for example, the Blue Angels, which spew pollution and a great deal of noise when they come to the Bay Area in October mm-hmm. to put on their shows at the cost of millions of our tax dollars mm-hmm. or other things that you've seen. And I'll also just quickly say on a personal note, last Tuesday I went to Anza Borrego State Park, which was a really heart-opening experience of seeing the incredible flowering of the desert there. Mm-hmm. And then on the way back on Highway 10, which runs next to a rail line, I saw a train with at least 100 cars, open flat cars, and on each of those was a tank uh-huh. in its desert tan. I'm guessing that those tanks are going to the Marine base at 29 Palms, north of Palm Springs, for war game exercises. But it was quite the shock and contrast with the beautiful desert that I had been in to see those 100 tanks going full speed on the rail line as I drove. Ah.
Cecile, do you want to weigh in at this moment?
Yes. I've been very privileged some time ago to see an exhibition of photographer Richard Mizrahi at the Oakland Museum. It was a photo documentary, if you like, of what has happened to the Mojave Desert. And essentially, it has become a dump site for the U.S. military activity. There are pits of severely contaminated water that are colored rust and chartreuse, just completely appalling colors. There are abandoned ordnance. There are abandoned military vehicles rusting away. This is just the Mojave. But equally, we could photograph other areas of the world. For example, the area of the world where in Gulf One, the U.S. strafed and bombed the retreating Iraqi army mm-hmm. and left trails of gutted, incendiated vehicles for miles and miles. But not only that, left them contaminated with depleted uranium, so that now in that area of Iraq, of 100 live births, 15 births are severely monstrous. That to say they would be called in the medical field, they would be called teratomas. These are children with one eye, born without a head, for example, or with their internal organs external to their bodies. These are living beings, and they must be cared for by parents, basically whose resources in terms of maintaining their own lives have been extremely compromised. Iraq was the breadbasket of the Middle East. Now it imports 80% of its food. There's a food crisis in Iraq. Obviously, there is a famine crisis in Yemen. But additionally, there is infrastructure crisis in Iraq. Water supplies are contaminated or vulnerable. The sewage systems have been bombed to smithereens. So this is a foreign landscape if we could see it with our eyes and measure its destruction. But equally, there are such sites here domestically in this country. So, for example, there are test sites not only where nuclear weapons have been tested in the Nevada test site, but there are also all over the country manufacturing concerns which involve themselves with the production and testing of depleted uranium. So that essentially there are bombing ranges all over this country as well. And then we can go into, for example, the bombing range that exists in Puerto Rico, at Vieques, where those soils are completely contaminated. And we could go even farther and talk about what happened in Hawaii to the island called Kahoʻole, where the U.S. used that island as a bombing range, so much so that it cracked the water table, so that island could no longer support any kind of growth, could not support life anymore. And it is to the credit of Native Hawaiians who have returned to that island and very, very laboriously have begun to try to make things grow again. And I haven't followed that story, so I can't tell you where it exists today. But I published a book 2 years ago called Apology to a Whale, and I just want to read the epigraph to your readers, because I think perhaps it sums up where we stand in terms of militarism vis-a-vis what is happening to this extraordinarily precious and exquisite planet of ours. Quote, "We are at the crucial moment in the commission of a crime. Our hand is on the knife. The knife is at the victim's throat. We are trained to kill. We are trained to turn the earth to account, to use it, market it, make money off it, take it for granted. Logically, we will never be able to reverse this part of our culture in enough time to stop that knife in our hand. But that is the task at hand, to cease this act of violence." And that's by Charles Bowden in his book, The Sonoran Desert.
Is that the Charles Bowden who wrote about the situation along the U.S.-Mexico border?
Yes.
We lost him a few years ago.
Yes.
Thank you for that, Cecile. Well, you use the word culture, and that brings to mind, of course, that's part of your area of expertise. But I've also looked at an article called Militarism and Climate Change, The Elephant in the Living Room. And one of the points that the author of that article made, who is, by the way, Florian Polsterer, was that after the Gulf War, the term military-industrial complex was merged with media and entertainment. And I think, you know, Janet, I know you've done some media criticism. You've written about some of the films about war and militarism, and I wonder if you want to have a word on that.
Yes, thank you, Karen. I read that article, and I thought that was a really brilliant point that hadn't been made in quite that way, at least that I'd read, how crucial media, including what we call news media, and then entertainment such as films and TV shows, are intertwined, funded by, and reflect the military mindset in a way that, you know, reaches children and reaches deep into our hearts, minds, and nervous systems. So this brings to my mind a review I did of American Sniper, which was a major blockbuster Hollywood film about a man who was a sniper in Iraq and who was eventually killed himself by another traumatized veteran when they had both returned to the United States. It was up for an Academy Award for Best Picture, which shows the deep cultural acceptance of this kind of narrative, which was highly propagandized. And actually, I did some research on the man who was that sniper, and of course, many details of his life were sort of elided over. But anyway, I wrote that review, and I'm happy to say that it was one of the most read things on the CodePink.org blog, which is called Pink Tank. And it was one way in which I looked at how acceptable it is when put in terms of one person's courage, valor, and shooting skills, that Americans go to other countries and kill people, not once, but many times. This particular sniper killed over 160 Iraqis, at least one of whom was a child. And in the film, American Sniper, it's constructed so that we as the audience accept as justifiable this sniper's murder of a child. That is a very sinister development that I've seen in some other films, which I think is somewhat of a new development, that children are shown as combatants, terrorists, or potential terrorists, and thus it is justified that they be killed.
We're going to take a short break to thank some of our sponsors, and we'll be back with Janet Wheel and Cecile Pineda in just a moment. Well, we were just listening to some hard facts and hard realities about the impacts of war and militarism in the United States on our environment. But earlier, we were also talking about how movements are starting to be a little bit more connected, and there's been leadership coming from new places that's refreshing and helps make another link in the sort of tripartite movement linking that I mentioned at the top, and that would be anti-war, climate justice, and social justice. Janet, do you have any words about where we're at right now with respect to struggles for both climate change and peace, and where we're at in terms of linking in social justice and a real social justice lens into even understanding those issues?
I would like to highlight the work of U.S. military veterans in this, in answering your question, Karin. As an example of some very positive work that's being done, the Veterans for Peace organization has sent delegations both to Jeju Island in South Korea, where the people there have been very dedicated in resisting the building of a naval base that would destroy their unique coral environment and their beautiful sea there at Jeju Island, and also to Okinawa, Japan, which has been under continuous U.S. military occupation since the end of World War II. Okinawa has had to bear the brunt, as the rest of Japan has not, of the physical occupation and environmental destruction and the social devastation caused by U.S. military bases on the islands of Okinawa, which is the southernmost part of the Japanese archipelago. Mm-hmm. when I see the photos and read the accounts from these veterans who connect with and work beside and very much learn from and have great respect for the Korean and Japanese activists, I really feel very heartened, both in terms of other Americans going and, you know, doing things, getting arrested, bearing witness, taking photographs, doing media work, and all the rest of what the Veterans for Peace have been doing. I'm very heartened by that as an American, and it's also an example of how someone's heart and mind can change, mm-hmm. because all of those people on those delegations as young men were brainwashed into becoming, if not killers themselves, at least part of a killing army, mostly in Vietnam, but a few of them in Korea as well. And then the other example that I'd like to give of bringing these three strands together was the very heart-opening, moving example led by Wesley Clark Jr., the son of General Wesley Clark and himself, a U.S. Army veteran. He organized thousands of younger veterans to go to North Dakota and try to stop the laying of the Dakota Access Pipeline through Native land, through the Sioux people's territory. And as part of that effort, he and other veterans knelt before the chief of one of the Lakota nations and asked their forgiveness as U.S. Army veterans for the destruction that the U.S. Army has done to the people and lands of the Sioux, and in particular, General Custer. And that ceremony of forgiveness was one of the most amazing and touching things I've seen in a long time. And the young veterans asking for forgiveness was received in a very beautiful, dignified, and compassionate way by the Sioux people. And that is an example of how we can be allies and how we can get away from the white savior complex, which I think is something that all of us white people, frankly, who engage in activism, need to be on the alert for in ourselves, and you know, to not continue to go down that path, but rather to walk a very humble and receptive path and be open to the teaching, the leadership, the guidance, the wisdom of people of color.
Could I chime in a minute?
People. Absolutely, Cecile.
Could I chime in a minute here? I think it was Chief Iron Eyes who received that apology. And what to me was the most absolutely riveting aspect of that whole ceremony was his response. He didn't say, on behalf of the Sioux Nation, blah, 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 this and that, I, this and that. His response was, quote, "Peace on earth. Peace on earth." That's what I wanted to share.
Thank you.
You know, Janet, you just helped me make a connection in my mind in talking about white sort of savior mode in activism. And what I connected that to was earlier when you talked about the narrative underneath the story in American Sniper being about essentially a hero. It reminded me, I've been reading a lot of books lately about the history of the Central Intelligence Agency and particularly their propaganda operations. And one of the core narratives that they use is the hero narrative. And it's very much a core narrative of our culture. And in that sense, white people, maybe who people of privilege who see ourselves as coming in and rescuing others, may be succumbing to that same narrative that's used in a very dominator way. I just wanted to throw that in there. Cecile, I wanted to get a chance to get back to you. One of the things I was thinking about in terms of linking struggles was the perspectives of people of color in struggle in the past. That, for example, Muhammad Ali refusing to fight in Vietnam said he was a person of color and he had no fight with the Vietnamese and he wasn't going to go fly over there and kill them. I remember Black Panthers and Malcolm X linking the struggles for black freedom in America with the anti-imperialist struggles that were then going on in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, where those people in those countries were throwing off their colonial dominators. What do you think happened to that? In your investigation into the deep roots of our violence and our destructiveness as a culture, where are we on that kind of consciousness?
I think we're in a very good place, relatively speaking, to where we have been. I think that I'm going to say this out loud. I think that the arrival of Trumpism, in a sense, has been a blessing to this society because the word blessing, you know, is a two-edged sword. It means may good things come to you, but it also means a wounding. I think that people couldn't wash their hands and go home for another 4 years of prosperity. That's quote-unquote. They had to bestir themselves, and to that end, very specifically, the Black Lives Matter movement has now made a common cause with the Fight for 15. So in other words, what we're seeing now is the awareness that we need to make coalition with groups that separately, well, I think to use your expression, have been operating in their own silos, to make those connections. And for us in the so-called peace movement, I think it is very important for us to link with the global warming movement, because the movement against global warming, because militarism and global warming are inextricably linked. The U.S. military essentially supplies 5% of all the carbon emissions on the planet in any given year. And that it's huge. 5% says absolutely nothing because it needs to be compared to something else. But I have been thinking about this issue going back. I'm looking at the quality of our culture, which is so insidiously militarized, not only in terms of entertainment, but in terms of video games, in terms of clothing, where people actually find wearing camo fashionable. And I've been thinking very much about the roots of where that comes from. And you probably know I published a book called Apology for a Whale, because the book that I had previously published, Devil's Tango, How I Learned the Fukushima Step by Step, left me with a question. And it's the question that you quoted with Joanna Macy summarizing it as, what has happened to our minds that we are destroying our world? And just now, I happened to be reading Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz's Indigenous History of the United States, Indigenous People's History of the United States by Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz.
Who's been on our show.
Yes, and this book I recommend should be part of every school, every American school child's introduction to American history, because it tells the history that couldn't be told, because it is the history of the vanquished, not of the victor. And she makes a very interesting point in the chapter called Bloody Footprints, that the militarism of this country bears the stamp of the original colonial settler mentality of going after Indians in order to clear the land. So, for example, she draws the parallel here where our killing machines in this very day are named after various tribes: Iroquois, Kiowa, Mohawk, Cayuse, Apache, Choctaw, Black Hawk, Thunderbird, Rolling Thunder. We've heard all of these tribal names applied to various military hardware. And she makes another very, very telling point, which to me just surprised me. I hadn't thought about it. We've all heard the expression in country. In other words, you see action in country. And what that means is on foreign soil. Well, it's short for in Indian country. That's where it comes from. But it goes even further back than that, because in the process of trying to answer the question, what has happened to our mind that we're killing our world, I had to go way back. And I came up with a hypothesis that I briefly want to share with your listeners. And that is, there has been an assumption that, oh, well, human nature is this way. Human beings have always made war. Even animals make war. Look at the chimpanzees. Well, look at the bonobos, okay? Mm-hmm. They solve their tensions with sexual activity and sexual display. I'm sure it's a lot more fun than making war. But in any case, mankind, humankind, apparently did not always make war. In the peninsula, which we call a continent of Europe, until 3500 BC, there was a peace-loving society. It was an egalitarian society in which all genders, including other than just the typically masculine and feminine genders, but all in between, were more or less looked upon with tremendous equality. Men's graves were no more decorated than women's graves. There were no weapons. There is evidence that these people were hunter-gatherers, and also that they had become very simple agriculturalists as well. And roughly 3500 BC, more or less, there was an invasion of what we now call Europe from the Russian steppe by a people that are called Kurgan, K-U-R-G-A-N. And they're called Kurgan because they're named after their burial sites. This is the origin of what we think of as white Europe and white Europeans, because the Kurgans brought to Europe, they brought, first of all, weapons. There had been no weapons before that. With weapons, of course, they brought warfare. With warfare, they brought hierarchy and patriarchy. They also brought religion. They brought the religion of a sky god, a male sky god, where there was no possibility anymore of rebirth, and which replaced the previous religion of the old Europeans, who were mother goddess worshippers and who celebrated an entire cycle of birth, death, and rebirth. And the last and most lethal weapon they brought with them was their language. Their language was Proto-Indo-European. Every single European language, with the exception of four, are derived from Proto-Indo-European. Why is that a fatal language? Because, according to the Worf hypothesis, language embeds the deepest cultural assumptions of a people. That is why the study of Native American languages has been so very important, because it has taught us that there exists in the world a different way of thinking, not of competition, not of victory, not of heroes, but of collaboration, of sharing, of understanding that we do not own the soil, we do not own the landscape, that the earth owns us. And it's a completely divergent way of thinking and complete opposition to what we think of in our common way of thinking in the Western, the white European world. That's what I discovered. And in order, I think, for us to be able to get a sense of where we really are, we have to understand where our mindset originated. Because until we do, it gives us no protection from ourselves and our own murderous instincts. So that's what I've discovered.
I want to thank you for that, because essentially in that excellent summary of what you learned from your writing your book, Apology to a Whale. You've answered the question that had been in my mind, which was, we're talking about so much horror and such deep roots of violence in our civilization.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people just feel like, I don't want to hear it. How can you spend all your time looking into this stuff? It's so overwhelming. But what I just heard you say is that if you dig deep enough, you can find the root, essentially, which is what you need when you're working in your garden. You need to find the root if you're going to really pull it out.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. And I will say, you know what? A lot of writers make all kinds of pretensions about why they write, and it's all very ennobling and all of that. But to be perfectly honest, we would all have to say, us writers, we would all have to cop to the fact that we write for ourselves. And I have to say that with my discoveries, it put my heart at some state of rest. In other words, it's one of the ways that I can cope with confronting what really is obscene, what cannot be understood, what cannot be accepted, which is beyond the pale, beyond all reason. But it gives me the courage to be able to look at it, because it's helped me to put what I'm seeing in perspective.
Mm-hmm. Janet, do you want to say a word about that, about how looking at the roots of really difficult things is not always debilitating?
Yes, thank you, Cecile. That was beautiful. I wanted to say first something about language and psychology. I have taken up one word out of the vast vocabulary that supports the worldview of militarism, and that word is defense. And I speak up against it and ask my allies and colleagues and strangers who are doing good work opposing war and militarism, but talk about the defense budget, mm-hmm. or even defense industries.
Uh-huh.
The word defense has a lot of warm connotations. It has the connotations of protection.
We're getting a little bit of loss on the phone line there. You want to start again, Janet?
Okay, sorry. Can you hear me okay now?
Sounds good now.
Okay. So anyway, just quickly, the word defense, as in defense budget, and by the way, it's an additional $54 billion that Trump wants to lavish on the military-industrial complex on top of $600 billion just for the next fiscal year. So anyway, but getting back to the word defense, that has a connotation of warmth, safety, and protection, all very positive things. The so-called defense budget is nothing of the kind. The Department of so-called defense is the most offensive bureaucracy that could possibly exist.
And maybe more than one sense of the word.
Right. So please, I'm asking all of us, everybody hearing this, to not ever use the word defense again. The correct word is military. But getting to your question, Karen, of in the face of these really terrible things, you know, how do we sustain ourselves and how do we continue to look, speak, write, and act against death and for life, really.
Mm-hmm.
And I go to my memories of standing at vigil at Creech Air Force Base in Nevada, 45-minute drive from Las Vegas, where I've been with Cecile and many other folks over the years. And, you know, on the one hand, seeing this vast Air Force Base for drone warfare, or it's actually not even warfare, just drone assassination, that is ripping the delicate flora of the desert right off, that's sucking up so much money, and so many terrible things are happening in those little closed structures where the drone operators sit in darkness and look at screens and press joysticks and kill and wound people in other countries. So that's on the one hand. And literally on the other hand, or as I turn and look, I see the sky, the vast vistas of southern Nevada, the still uncontaminated, rugged brown mountains. And one time when I was there, I saw these beautiful copper-colored small dragonflies, thousands of them, rising up from the earth. And the military slang for drones is dragonflies. And so to see the actual living dragonflies gave me some kind of hope that life does persist and that we are going to get beyond this as human beings, and that this is not a curse that we have to live with forever.
Well, with that reminder, we're going to move into the final segment of our show and talk about resistance. And I don't know if that's the word that you two would use, but it's very popular these days. I'm going to give you each an opportunity to list some things that are going on with respect to the military budget or the climate movement that people can get involved with. Cecile, you already mentioned the resolution that David Swanson helped get passed in Charlottesville, New Haven, and where was the other?
Montgomery County, Maryland.
Thank you. And that's available. You mentioned, let's put it out again, Mary at World Beyond.
WorldBeyondWar.org. Just ask for help. And you could put in the subject line, reverse militarism. And I think that that will put her in exactly the frame where you want to talk with her. Again, it's Mary at WorldBeyondWar.org. To me, that's very encouraging that this movement, I think, has the potential of a groundswell. I equally see that now we are just on the threshold of making the very, very important linkage between global warfare on the one hand and climate collapse on the other. They are related. Their relationship mathematically is parallel. As we make more war, we have more climate collapse. That we need to emphasize that the use of the of fossil fuels by the military is an endlessly spiraling end game, because in the process of fighting to, quote, secure more oil for their purposes, the military is using yet more oil.
Right.
In other words, it is an Ouroboros, the snake which is eating its own tail, and the tail that it's eating, unfortunately, is our planet. I think that that linkage is very important, and to that end, I think that Janet's looking very carefully at words. Language is very powerful. By calling it defense, we basically whitewash the whole thing, and we wash our hands of murder. I think it's an offense industry. I think we have to call it what it is. I think we have to call murder for what it is. Unfortunately, and this is of great concern to me, we have been using the word peace for 40, 50 years. As the Bible says, there will be cries for peace and more cries for peace, but there will be no peace.
And with that, I'm sorry, I have to interrupt you, Cecile, because we're out of time and we have a few announcements to make, but we really want to thank both our guests. Janet Wheel has joined us from Palm Springs. And Janet, people can follow you on Twitter at Janet R. Wheel, right?
Yes, and that's spelled W-E-I-L.
Okay, Janet R. W-E-I-L. And Cecile, I know your website is CecilePineda.com.
Yes.
How else should people look for you, your books, your talks?
So my website, CecilePineda.com, as well, they can go for my books to Wings Press, that's one word, wingspress.com, and for my weekly blog newsletter, if they want to be added to the list, email me at CecilePineda, that's seven letters, the last letter being P as in Peter, at sonic.net.
Great. Thank you both for being with us, and now we're going to move into some announcements. Bing, let's do a reminder quickly of the fundraiser you have coming up.
Yes, on Sunday, April 23rd at 6 p.m. at the Dance Palace, we have an insider's perspective, Lynn Woolsey and Mark Dowie in conversation. Lynn Woolsey was our progressive U.S. congressman from 1993 to 2013, and Mark Dowie is an investigative historian who lives on the edge of Tamales Bay. And I'd like to also announce that West Marin Standing Together will have a general meeting on Saturday, April 8th. Saturday, April 8th. Mark your calendars, and that's at 3 p.m. at the Dance Palace.
Great. Tonight, Occupy Sonoma County presents, Is Global Climate Disruption Happening to Us or For Us? They're looking at both opportunities and challenges. That's tonight, 7 to 9 at the Peace and Justice Center. Request a donation and a pay what you can plant sale and free seed exchange. Coming up, March for Science Nationwide, Saturday, April 22nd. You go to marchforsciencesf.com or other cities have it on Facebook. People's Climate March coming up April 29th. Bing's going to D.C. and they're happening here in Santa Rosa. They're happening in Oakland, San Jose. So you can go to 350.org and find your own site. And we hope our next show to be with Nick Buxton, author of The Secure and the Dispossessed, How the Military and Corporations Are Shaping a Climate Changed World. So thank you all. That does it for today's Post Carbon Radio, and we will see you in 2 weeks. Stand by for Cruisin' with Rick Clark.
I'm trying to spread the word about this immense issue, but I find it absurd why so many people are confused. Some people don't understand the weight of this problem. Act now before it gets out of hand, cause Earth is calling. I was 10 years old, exposed to it. The inconvenient truth really made me concerned how it was going to affect the youth. The temp is still rising from the pollution we produce. We need to start striving for a solution to reduce. When we burn fossil fuels like coal and gasoline, we're using dirty energies when we should be using clean. When we burn, we're adding to the greenhouse effect. CO2, CH4, and N2O collect in our atmosphere. They remain up there for years and years, absorbing sun rays that come near.